Second hour, Darren Donick and Chase here on this Friday morning. Steve Watterson, longtime strength and conditioning coach of the Titans at the bottom of the hour. Don't forget, you can stream us from anywhere in the world. It's very easy to do. Download the Game Nashville app. That's free and easy. You can enable Alexa Skill or Google Home. If you have that set up in rooms in your house or your office like I do, just ask it to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, which is thegamenashville.com. We say hello to Richard Deitch from The Athletic. Richard, how you doing?
What's going on, guys?
How you been? How was the Toronto bubble?
Say again? As a Toronto bubble?
I know
my
you were
Toronto
weren't
bubble? Or,
yes. or the actual Toronto bubble,
or
right?
The actual Toronto bubble. Yeah. Well, you know, again, the same issues that exist in the States exist in Toronto writ large. The difference is that because it's a smaller country, and without getting too political for you guys, sort of just a different approach to science and stuff like that. You know, it is a little safer here. You certainly have COVID. You certainly have other stuff. It's just sort of all in a in smaller form, and so things are okay. I mean, nothing is great, but things are okay would be the best possible way. I mean, as a human being with little people, you know, I'm on my knees sort of praying to whatever God I'm praying to regarding school opening again, so that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, luckily, Metro Nashville has opened back up, thank goodness, and they're able to start playing again and getting back to school. Want to ask you, why do you think there's been, and what do you make of the about-face of the Big Ten, Pac-12? Looks like Mountain West is about to jump back in the fray for the fall. Looks like the MAC is about ready to jump. You know, I've been using I'm just drawing blanks. So what's the movie, guys? I've been referencing all week. I'm completely blanking. The Will Ferrell movie.
Old School.
Old School. Thank you. Jeez. You know, they all took off streaking through the quads to the gymnasium, and they got to the gym, and they turned around, and nobody was following them. So they went back to the house and went back to the party where Snoop is and everybody else. So what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, let's just be honest first and foremost. Like, when people say it's not about money, it's always about money, like as a general rule, 99% of the time. So the Big Ten's decision, the Pac-12 decision is about money. These athletic departments and schools in particular need the television revenue that fuels all the athletic departments, that fuels all the that fuels many things beyond football, and certainly at these schools. So first and foremost, this is a financial decision beyond anything. And I feel like if the university presidents, athletic directors, et cetera, are more honest about that, whether I like it or not, I would just respect that. So
yeah.
That's first and foremost. Secondly, you know, I'm not, and I know this is a very hot button issue where you guys are in Nashville, certainly compared to where I used to live in New York, in Toronto. I'm not someone who sort of reflexively is like college football shouldn't exist at all. Obviously I want these guys to be safe, and I would like to believe, at least at a base minimum, that schools are going to protect their, I call them athlete students, not student athletes, as best as possible. My frustration, here's where my frustration lies. When it comes to the pros, I absolutely think and respect that they have a decision to make when it comes to playing in a place where COVID exists. They're compensated for that risk, and they're compensated for that decision. So whether I would play or not, I feel like is irrelevant. If Tom Brady makes a decision to play NFL football this year, he makes that as an adult of sound mind, and he makes it while being compensated significantly for that decision, for my entertainment, for the Bucks finances. That's something I can live with and I respect. What is immensely frustrating to me is college students don't get that. They're not compensated for this risk. And it's total BS to say that they're compensated by room and board and free education. That is nonsense. What these kids represent to these universities in terms of the what they are worth as an asset to universities is immense. You guys know this. I don't even know if I can put a price on what Trevor Lawrence is worth to Clemson. $10 million? $20 million? Once you get into like what he represents in terms of making that school attractive to places like ESPN or Fox or CBS. So that's my frustration is like, if these kids are playing, these kids deserve to be paid, and they deserve to be paid significant money the way the NCAA is set up, including Title IX and everything else, they can't get compensated. So that's where my frustration lies. So I'm not a hater on it, and I'm not reflexively like, you know, I don't, these kids shouldn't play. It's just so frustrating to me that they are taking risk, regardless of what the infections rates are for 18 to 21 year olds. They're taking risk without being compensated for it. The very definition of being a worker. And so that's sort of where it lies for me. And I certainly can respect others who would disagree with that, but that's where I come off.
Richard Deitch from The Athletic on the line with us. For months we sat here in our homes. We had no sports, and we had great interviews, great discussions, but we weren't talking about really anything live. And we thought when live sports came back, everybody would be drooling and everybody would come running back as quick as possible. Why do you think through 2 weeks, the one that has always been, you know, Wonder Woman with the bracelets or a shield, you know, nothing affects the NFL for the most part. Why do you think it's down 10% through the first 2 weeks in ratings?
Down a little less. But again, as I've said many, many times, ratings viewership are not the result of one thing, the result of multiple factors. You know, ask me the same question. Why was game three the least watched game three of the Stanley Cup final in like 18 years?
Yeah.
You know, is it because of all the slogans and signs and the woke NHL players who are lecturing you? I mean, you'd look at me and laugh. That's not going on in the NHL. So first and foremost, I don't subscribe to the notion that NFL ratings are down because of a singular thing, whether that is more social justice or whether that is cord cutting. I think it is a reflection of multiple things. So first and foremost, if you're asking me why I think it's down, I think the most obvious thing is competition. NFL football is playing in a competitive landscape where if you look at the cable news networks during that time, their numbers are massively up. And so they're going against, news in a massive election season. So that's sort of first and foremost. Secondly, always matchup driven. You know, keep this in mind. So you go across the ratings, and yeah, the networks across the board in every national televised window are down. I think it's 7 or 8% at this point. But look at individual ratings. Fox's late afternoon doubleheader is up. Why is it up? Well, they had the Bucks and the Saints the first week. It's not really a genius take. Monday Night Football on this coming Monday, I guarantee you will be up double digits, if not, well, it can't be higher. Right? This is why journalists are not doing math. It will be up double digits in some kind of form because they have the Chiefs and Ravens. This is not a genius take by me. Like, that is the game of the year. And so corresponding against week three of 2019, this game is going to be way up. So my thesis is, again, all right, so what? All of a sudden, like, so you're boycotting the NFL in the afternoon, but you're not boycotting the NFL on Monday night because it's an awesome game. So, you know, secondly, obviously there are massive television factors such as, cord cutting. Far less people now have cable than they did before. So that's going to affect certainly the numbers on ESPN. It may affect the numbers on television. And lastly, there is something going on, I think, with the NFL in terms of fantasy football numbers being down, in terms of gambling being down a little bit. This is more theory than anything else. I do wonder if, because there was no exhibition season, it's just going to take a little bit longer for people to get into the season. As much as I hate exhibition football, I don't know if you guys buy that at all, but if you remember, I mean, I realize, you know, every day in America is a 24/7 news cycle, so it's hard to remember 3 weeks ago. But if you remember the week before the NFL started, didn't you feel that there was sort of far less publicity for the NFL than you've ever had before? I think that's the reason why Hard Knocks, lowest Hard Knocks viewership in history, not just by a lot, but like 60%. So that's sort of another sort of at least thesis on my part that it we didn't really have the run-up that we did. But I would not expect – if you ask me today, do I think NFL viewership will be down for the year? I do. I just can't tell you how much, and I think it's going to be like a seismograph. I think certain weeks you're going to get these great numbers, and then other weeks you're going to get some lousy numbers. I think right around the election, I mean, I think that week could tank. They're going up against the debate one night. That's going to tank. I mean, you know, just look around you in your own country. It's just – I mean, everything is at its most polarized and heightened sense. And, I think it's hard for people just to make sort of turn off the switch and just head to football, let's say, on a Monday night. But it's interesting, very interesting story, and all the ratings are interesting. You know, college football is down like 50%, but, you know, I think that's an obvious one. You're not having the best teams play the best teams. So, lastly, the takeaway I think I would just give to your audience is sports viewing is up on the whole. More people are watching more sports right now in terms of actual minutes than ever before, but because there's so much sports, the fragmentation means that these individual sports are down. That's how I would look at it.
That's a really interesting point. That's an important point. Richard Deitch is with us from The Athletic, from the media circus. So, Richard, a related question, because when those viewers are sitting there and watching, I know all of the television producers and directors are trying to create the best atmosphere possible with the sound and the feel of the game. There's been so many things. So now you have the NFL coming in after they've watched the other leagues do this for a while. What is your observation? Because we went through this process for me personally with the Predators. We had big discussions in our meetings, how much, and Fox had a say in it too. They didn't want too much of the noise. They had to tweak it, you know, all of these things. So what do you think of the NFL and their sound effects when you're watching their games?
When you're talking about just in, over every different sport or just the NFL?
Just the NFL, because they've had a chance to watch the other sports. And so they've had a chance to plan how much crowd noise is the right amount of noise, how do we do it, what's the noise level, all of that.
Yeah, I think that's very trial and error. And I think if you hear the producers and the announcers in the NFL, they'll say the same thing. The NFL Films was the group that produced all these different sounds and was sort of more running it. You know, the league was sort of running it initially, and I think the broadcasters now becoming a little bit more involved. I find, you know, on a personal note, I have found it a little overwhelming in late-game situations. I feel like the noise is, it's really over the top a little bit, and it doesn't necessarily match the drama on the field. But, you know, again, I get what they're trying to do because they want to try to create as much sort of audio excitement as possible. I think it's a very, very hard job, and it's amazing that they actually have been able to do what they've done in terms of try to duplicate each of the different stadiums and each of the different franchises. I have found it, in general rule, the NFL to be a little like if it was a volume, it's like volume 9 for me, and I kind of wish it was volume 7 or 6. But that's just personal opinion. I would imagine you have other people in your audience who are like, we really, really like this. I do think, though, they'll get it better each week and they'll sort of figure out what works or what doesn't. I do know, having talked to the directors and the producers and announcers, they like it. They like having sound in their ear. They like having the audio part of the game because it makes it feel like a much more normal broadcast. What will be interesting is, what do you do when you get, you know, let's say, knock on wood, things get a little bit better, and December games somewhere, like, you can get 25,000 socially distanced in some stadium. Now, how much do you use this external noise versus the noise of 25,000,
right,
let's say, as opposed
to 60,000? And how do you blend it?
Great question. I don't know. That's going to be interesting. I'll tell you this, you know, I think the NFL is going to pull this off. I think there's just too much money at stake. I think they obviously have their sort of testing so far been done really good. What happens at the Super Bowl? So, one, how many people are at that game? And then, two, like you said, do you use the natural crowd sound of a Super Bowl, which actually can be a little corporate of a crowd if you think about it, or do you try to enhance it? So some interesting questions coming up, particularly with the games from the NFL that matter when it comes to, you know, revenue and the number of viewers, et cetera.
Baseball is going to have a little bit like hockey, the NCAA tournament feel. Baseball all day, 2 out of 3, a lot of high stakes next week. How do you think that will go with viewership and kind of a one-off? It's probably never going to be exactly like this again.
Well, you know, the thing about baseball is, you know, the popularity of baseball is kind of a weird one to me, in that it's very, very popular in local markets, depending on how those local markets are doing. And it's a little tricky to figure out nationally how popular the sport is. I'm actually very curious to see what the viewership will be come the postseason, because, one, you have an extra game, so you have this extra wild card round, which brings in two other teams, which is pretty interesting. And then, secondly, baseball's World Series and Championship Series is going to compete against more competition, or different kind of competition, I guess maybe more accurate, than they ever have before. So I think the sport is popular. Obviously, it just had its 2 days ago, Turner just re-upped for, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars to get a extra wild card round and to continue its continuous relationship. They'll now have Tuesday night baseball as opposed to Sunday night baseball. So the sport is healthy. I'm just really curious to see what kind of viewership numbers we're going to get for the postseason and for a season that, you know, was unlike any other, and you didn't have this 162 game run up. I don't know. My sense is that this is going to be a low rated World Series, but I'd be happy to be proven wrong.
We're talking to Richard Deitch of The Athletic, the author of The Media Circus. And, you know, one of the things that we got early on in the pandemic was The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, and then eventually the return of NASCAR. And now they're getting together, Denny Hamlin and Michael Jordan, forming a NASCAR team with, and I'm not saying that, you know, the ratings have skyrocketed for NASCAR, but they have definitely seen some improvements at spots, being one of the first to return, and then a lot of eyes on them with Bubba Wallace. He'll be the driver. What do you make of this relationship with MJ becoming a car owner?
I think it's great. I mean, it's huge for NASCAR, I think. I mean, you know, is there a more famous living American athlete than Michael Jordan? I don't think so.
Probably
I mean,
not.
maybe it's LeBron, but it's, you know, it's tough to, I mean, it's probably Jordan or LeBron in terms of American, obviously. I think it's phenomenal. I mean, anytime you can get somebody with that kind of marketability, that kind of known entity, that kind of money, somebody sort of stands for excellence, I think it's great. I have no idea how good the car will be in the circuit, because a lot of celebrity owners obviously have come in, and usually the people who succeed obviously are long-time people on the sport. But I think it's huge for NASCAR. I mean, let's just be blunt. Very prominent African-American in a sport that has told you that it really needs to increase its diversity and people of color. So that in itself is huge. NASCAR, you're right. Early on, great numbers. Started off with a bang. The Bristol race a week ago, lowest Bristol race in history. Televised wise. Now again, I know I'm repeating myself, and I know I get called out on this for Twitter. Why are you hammering this? Why are you being such a knucklehead? Well, again, I would just say this: was NASCAR ratings really down last week because of all those woke NASCAR drivers lecturing you about politics, or was it because they were facing the most increased sports competition in the history of this amazing race at Bristol? You don't need to be a genius to sort of figure this out. So NASCAR has the same issues the NFL has. They have the same issues that the NHL has. They have the same issues that the NBA has. Their larger issue, though, I think long-term, is, you know, they got to, in my opinion, they got to bring more people into the sport, I think, to just sort of to try to grow it as best as you can. And I think the smartest way to grow it is just to make it, make it a bigger tent. So you try to figure out, you know, to bring in people of color into that sport, to bring more women into that sport. I do think all the NASCAR old school people are going to stick with you because they grew up on it and they love it. The playoff system, to me, as a Yankee in New York, is a little confusing. And I do love NASCAR. I've attended 7 races. I found it really fascinating. It's an interesting sport to me. So they got to tweak some stuff, but I like it. I think the Jordan thing is good. And the one thing that's like always been interesting to me about NASCAR, I think you guys would know this being in Tennessee, you're closer to NASCAR than me, people would be surprised at how many people are fans of the sport that you would never expect to be fans of the sport. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just because kids grow up with cars, and they think, like, the idea of driving cars fast are pretty cool. And so, like, Michael Jordan was a NASCAR fan as a kid, like a big one. And I think you'd be surprised, particularly kids who grew up in the southern part of the country, who are, you know, adults who are NASCAR fans that you might never suspect. So I thought it was great for NASCAR. You know, you can't buy that kind of publicity if you're NASCAR to me.
Real quick, Richard, how successful do you think he needs to be with this? Because he hasn't exactly had a ton of success as an NBA owner or a front office guy.
Well, he should not have Kwame Brown driving any NASCAR car. That would be a terrible wow.
There's the first thing. Yeah.
That has to be the first Kwame Brown reference on national radio in a long time.
It is.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. Listen, it's hard. It's a hard sport to be good at. I mean, you've seen owners come in and crash and burn. And this is the thing with racing. You've seen a lot of rich billionaires come in on, like, F1 and other places, and they just crash and burn. So it would be important for him to have a competitive car. again, this is my novice NASCAR take, but generally speaking, I think to have a competitive car, you got to invest a load of money into, you know, your crew, your shop, the head of your racing team. So depending on how much money Jordan and his group were willing to put in, I think can correlate to success. I'm one who's always believed that, like, I think there are great drivers, but I think more than that, there are great cars and great teams. So I think if you give, like, a Bubba Wallace a great car, I think he can win. I think if you give some of these guys who have finished, like, 10th or 15th traditionally in NASCAR races, like, I think they can win. Maybe, like, Jimmy Johnson, Jeff Gordon, you know, Richard Petty, David Pearson, maybe some of these, Earnhardt, maybe some of these guys are, like, a little better than the rest of the group, and that's why they were all-timers. But I think, by and large, a lot of it, at least in my take, has to do with car and team. And so if they invest money, I think they can win. It's just a question of if you're Michael, like, you know, you're willing to lose for a couple of years and take a bath before you win. But I hope he does. I'm telling you, it would be just so cool to see, like, a Michael Jordan car, like, winning a big race. I just think that would be awesome.
I think you should have used your Kwame Brown line and just hung up the phone and just walked away from
him. The walk-off.
That would have been, yeah.
That was, I mean, a walk-off.
That's like a walk-off. That's like, that would have been like Anthony Davis against the Nuggets, and I should have walked off the phone.
I should have heard a click the minute you were done with that line, because that was beautiful.
But now that I'm a Canadian, I'm very polite and
you're friendly. You're friendlier.
The official takeoff. Yeah.
Good stuff as always. Thanks for the visit. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you down the road.
See you guys.
Richard Deitch from The Athletic will come back. Steve Watterson, longtime strength and conditioning coach for the Titans. By the way, a couple things to pass along. It looks like Jeff Brohm and Purdue are getting good news. Their stud wide receiver, Rondale Moore, has decided to opt back in. So it looks like they could be getting their big-time target. And on the hockey front, it looks like Ottawa is set to tell Bobby Ryan, thanks, we're putting you on waivers. And I guess they're going to buy him out.
Yep.
He has two more years on his deal, paying him $7.5 million per season. Per season. Hello.
Hi.
I guess that is going to be a cap hit of $3.5 million, $3.5 million, $1.8 million, $1.8 million the next 4 years for the Senators.
Hmm. Yeah, and according to Pierre LeBrun, he was the only one. Today's the first day of the buyout window. He was the only one on buyout waivers. Surely more will come, but I know that a lot of people are paying attention to that here in Nashville because of what could happen with Kyle Turris, but Bobby Ryan is the first.
Mm. Wow, just wanted to pass along. We'll come back with Steve Watterson on the other side. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. I feel good. I knew that I would not. Back here on Darren Donick and Chase on this Friday morning. You just made the list coming up at high noon. Who or what has made you mad? Looking forward to that. At noon, Daquan Jones from the Titans will join us at 12:30 to talk about his matchup and their matchup against the Vikings up in Minnesota. And we'll have Lee Sterling at 1 o'clock picking some games, and then we'll pick games with you, pick six, in the final hour. Longtime strength and conditioning coach for the Oilers and the Titans, Steve Watterson, is on the line with us. I'm pretty sure he trained Ken Stabler when he was the quarterback for the Oilers. Steve, how you doing?
Good morning, guys.
That's not true. That was not true what I said, is it? You did not train Ken Stabler.
He was one step before me.
Yeah, it's not that far of a gap. But
Warren Moon. Warren was the man. How about Oliver Luck?
Wow. Oh, there wow. You go. Oliver yeah. Luck.
Yep.
What do you make of all the injuries we've seen through 2 weeks in the league?
Well, it's not something that we didn't think was going to happen, because the greatest way to take a look at it is take a look at what happened during, you know, 10 years ago at the lockout. Athletes basically forced to train away from the training center. And the style of training was different. The level of training for each guy coming in was a little different. What they did in preparing for the season was different. And so then you had the compression of the preseason training, dumping all the athletes. And there was immediately, matter of fact, I can remember before the guys were even brought back in, Gatorade Sports Science Institute flew a dozen of us between athletic trainers and strength coaches out to California for kind of like a brain trust meeting. Just, come on, what's the predictors? What's going to go on? What's new in the science world? And I remember one of the sessions was actually predicting, coming up with a predictor of what we thought were going to be the greatest increase of injuries. And I specifically remember addressing the Achilles.
Which has been a problem in the first couple of weeks.
Again, there's a lot of rationale that can justify this. I wish it didn't, but the fact of the matter is when you have the athletes away, no matter how hard they train, when they're not training reactively, now, I'm not trying to get into the science of everything, into the neurology of how pathways work, but there is a difference, if you think about it, between cognitive training and reactive training. It actually works differently from your brain and all the way down into your spine and into the reaction of the muscles. So to give you an example, let's take a look at a basketball player. A basketball player can play out of their mind and they're just in a zone and everything is hitting and they're just, the range is right for them. Well, that didn't happen accidentally. It's because they had done things repetitively over and over and over, and everything neurologically was working for them to make those shots. Well, what happens in football is you can train cognitively. In other words, I put you through a set of drills, and you know where my foot is supposed to step each time. If I have you run 40 yards, you know you're going to run from 1 yard, from the goal line to the 40-yard line, and then you can deaccelerate. You cognitively know that. But when you're on the football field and you're reacting to somebody else's movement, and so you're really having to be both coordinated and agile, and what happens is you don't have that time to say, okay, I'm starting here, stopping there. It's reactive. And that actually neurologically is different than cognitive. And if it's not trained, you set yourself up for an injury. And I'm going to give you an example of what happened last year in the NBA Finals. Remember Durant?
Yeah.
Blew out the Achilles?
Yep.
No matter how hard they were able to let him rest and heal and try to get that tissue taken care of, he was definitely going to have to fall short in the reactive phase of hitting the athletes back. And so what happened was, sure enough, he got his foot in a bad position, tried to do an explosive move while the tendon was elongated, and pop. Mm. Muscle hadn't been trained to be in that range with an explosive force. That's really what we're seeing on the football field, is these athletes are coming back, and they might be in great shape. But now all of a sudden they're reacting at such a higher rate of speed than they were ever training at. They missed a lot of the adaptive training qualities that happen during that training camp and introduction and high volume, low volume. Every coach in the NFL knows third day of training camp, you really start decreasing in the amount of load. So no matter how much you tried to apply that model to what happened this year, it was compressed. And so it's going to relate to greater soft tissue injuries, specifically those injuries that have connective tissue, require that get the demand on them for an explosive movement, explosive action, and that's why you'll probably also see an increase in non-contact ACLs.
Which we've also seen. Steve Watterson on the line with us. I'll be curious with your answer on this one, just because you went through decades in the NFL as the surfaces changed, the playing surface changed. So you had the 49ers who just were absolutely decimated with injuries last week in East Rutherford against the Jets. All a bunch of their star players went down with injuries, a lot of ACL injuries. They complained that the surface was sticky. One, how much did that go on with over the decades of teams and players complaining about a playing surface, and how much did that factor through your experiences over decades into injuries that we see on the field?
Well, let's go back now. When I started my first year, I'll go back, was as an intern in 1978. And so then I was at the Philadelphia Eagles. That was the invincible year with Vince Papale. And so what field were we playing on at Veterans Stadium? With that whole baseball field. And they didn't change it to football and actually take out the infield till halfway through the season, just like at for the Raiders.
Yeah, Coliseum. Oakland, yeah.
Well, that was brutal. So, yeah, surface definitely makes a difference. And when they say sticky, that doesn't, for the fans out there listening, that doesn't mean it's like sticky like gum. That means sometimes they feel like the shoe grabs. Now, let me give you an example of this. I used to work with our field guys at the Titans. And they're great, great guys. Henry and Porch, they're two great guys that were very easy to work with. But I would make a point that the grass was too short. Now, you can say, well, what do you mean too short, Coach? How would that affect a player? You think that would be a better running surface?
Yeah, we had the same reaction as they did. We just were sitting here going, what?
Okay. Where would you, if you were playing a football game and you were playing it on the fairway or on surfaces like the green, where would you have more injuries?
I would say probably the green.
Absolutely. The reason is, imagine you getting up there for a putt and they dig in their spikes and they get all that surface contact. Well, you're out on the fairway, pretty hard to dig in. You're on this undulation, and there's less total surface contact between the shoe and the ground. So you have more liberty, more movement, almost like the ability to rotate. But when you stick that tight and there is zero ability to move between the shoe bottom and the surface, and that much contact, with any rotational change of direction forces, they're all absorbed up the chain from the ankle, a lot to the knee, even to the hip and the back. So the smoother the surface, the more friction, the more contact. Even sometimes if it's the same density, the softness, obviously the greens are more packed, but it's not the compaction as much as it's how much friction is made between the ground surface and the shoe. And if there's too much, that's an awful lot of load on those very strong, very explosive athletes that all gets transferred back to the body. And that's where, when not trained, high level of training, that's where that reactive movement really translates energy and relates into more injuries.
We're talking a long-time strength and conditioning coach for the Titans, Steve Watterson. Steve, you worked with so many players over the course of the years with the franchise, and I can remember you saying so much that availability is such a strength for a player. Tell us a story about maybe a player that, when he came into the league, really didn't have the understanding of what it took to stay available, keep his body, understand, maybe educate himself about some of these things that you're talking about. But as you worked with him, he really got it, and it led to a good career.
Well, I can go back all the way. I can go to a wide receiver that you may all know. Remember Drew Hill?
Sure. he was on some of my fantasy teams, for sure.
Okay, well, Drew Hill, when he came, we got him at the end of his career, coming over from the Rams. I can remember him being resistant. He was an older player, and he was like, golly, coach, what the heck is this? I mean, this is an awful lot of workload, and do we really need to be doing this much? I said, Drew, take a look at the workload. You'll find out that it's kind of an undulating load and that it looks like a lot on paper, but I really do adapt it based on variables, based on your strengths, your abilities, your liabilities as much as disabilities, your liabilities. That means what are you weakest at? And at that point, he had really started to tighten down. He wasn't as flexible as he needed to be. And he definitely had some muscle imbalances. But to make a long story short, I can remember after his second year, he came up to me and he goes, "Coach, I just want to thank you." He goes, "I feel better now than I felt in the last 7 or 8 years of my career." And it was because we addressed his specific needs, based on what his weaknesses were. I've always had these philosophies as far as addressing an athlete training in the offseason. Number one, tissue quality. Is the tissue prepared to train? Do you have any old scar tissue? Do you have any weaknesses? Is there any imbalances or tightnesses? Then there's tissue positioning. And that means, can you functionally move and can you complete the demands of that position? Because every position has different demands. Can you get into that range of motion and can you functionally move, recruit in that phase? Then you worry about the actual training, the training mechanism, tissue movement. And Drew Hill would probably be one of the earliest guys that I had that it was like an epiphany to him that, wow, I've just been out here trying to stay in shape, jog a little, lift a little, you know, do a few machines. I think one of the things that really set back the whole profession was the whole machine, the Nautilus phase of training, where we had guys just sitting on a machine thinking that we were just going to lift a weight in a linear motion, maybe get bigger muscles, and think that was preparing us for the very dynamic, multi-directional activities required in most sports.
Steve, right now, a lot of people are watching Jadeveon Clowney, who came in very late, and he's trying to get up to speed. Floyd Reese shared with us a conversation you two had where you told him it's going to take 6 weeks before you really get into good football shape. So what are the important things for the strength coach? Or, you know, what would you do with a player who came in late for a holdout or whatever the reason was to try to get him up to speed as fast and as safe as possible?
Well, with every athlete we ever had come in, and believe me, I didn't invent this. Great strength coaches have been doing it before I started doing it. And believe me, the gentleman, Frank Perino, working with Todd Torricelli over there, I guarantee they're doing everything and probably more than I ever did in preparing the athletes and knowing what needs to be done for that availability. Now, the first thing you do with an athlete, especially someone like Giovanni Clowney, and I'm going to compare him to Arakpo. Arakpo, I think it was 3 years in a row, he had major injuries, might have been four, before coming to us. He had, in fact, he had a couple of pec tears. I think there were two or three injuries into his upper extremity that really restricted his ability to complete the season. That's where the availability comes in. So we always did an evaluation, took a look at what they had done in the past, took a look at their injury profile, took a look at their fitness components, evaluated them, tested them, and then checked the tissue quality, and then built a program specific to their physiological needs. Now, that's the program. Now, the workload is the secret. Now, obviously, you got a head coach that played in the league, fully understands that workload can either make it, and if done improperly, can break it. You can't think that you can compress that time and try to fit more work in, but instead try to get quality work and let the bodies adapt and get used to tolerate the load, each practice, the amount of rest, and how you address that tissue. Because if you don't do it and you think it's just about the playbook, I mean, I don't know how a guy like Al Saunders, his playbook, they said, was like a War and Peace. It was the thickest, biggest book in the history of the NFL for offensive plays. I don't know how you could implement that in a lockout season or a compressed season. because you have to have so many reps doing these things. You have to be able to narrow down the workload and allow the players to adapt. I do believe that available at the end of this year, take a look at who's going to make it the furthest. It's going to be those that can manage the physiology, the body of the athletes, as much as it is the X's and O's.
We've talked to you about the science, the training, but part of your role for the Titans was that motivational part as well. Maybe the night before a game, we've seen you at various roasts. One of them was Floyd Reese that we got a good kick out of. But you would do this type of thing from time to time to get the players on the same page, get them a good laugh, get them in the right frame of mind the night before the game. How did you come up with your system of how to do that, to blend the right amount of comedy, the right amount of, you know, psychological, just getting the emotions going? How did you learn that skill?
I don't know. Maybe it's a fraternity days. Maybe going through Hell Week. Maybe getting which you can't do anymore. I mean, there are some things that I did in the past. I will say I spoke last year. I received an award at the NFL from my fellow strength coaches, which was just a beautiful honor. And one of the things I addressed to all the young players, young strength coaches, was be flexible and adapt to the times. You may have the greatest system in the world, but things come and go. Know what to throw out, what to add in. And if you're not malleable, if you're not making change with the time, you're going to have a tough time staying in. I think I always tried to stay current on what was best for the athletes. Now, with the sense of humor and stuff like that, it's a long year. I mean, you go through between off seasons, and then there's a little break, and then bring them back to camp. It is a long, intense time together. And I have to tell you, if you don't have a great locker room, a great relationships with the guys, then it really makes it much more difficult. The wins, the losses, it's a roller coaster. I mean, very few times you win all 16 games, as we know it. It's only happened once. And so that is a very difficult thing to go through. So you have to be able to adjust and realize the relationship is as important as sometimes what's in the X's and O's and the workload and the amount of weight they're lifting in the weight room, the ability to build trust, friendship, and a sense of humor.
Do you remember the first time you did one of those film presentations to the group with everybody in the classroom and they say, Steve, come on up here, give us your little talk, where you have the slide presentation stuff. When was the first time you ever did that?
Jeff had me do that because he wanted, there were so many more things that had to be covered. Everything from behavior. And I remember one of the first things I did that year, I think 2002, because I always did it just off the cuff, going through the expectations, more about here's the workout, here's how we do it, here's what my expectations are. I remember ending my presentations with the word coyote, coyote, C-O-Y-O-T. That means crap on your own time. I didn't want them coming into the weight room and then turning around and saying, I got to go to the bathroom. Yeah, do that on your own. Come in here ready to work. Have your shoes tied. Don't bring in food. When that whistle blows, we're going to get to work. And but then it started getting, we had to cover more topics. And one of them was behavior. And one of the things Jeff was always great about is telling the guys, you don't want to be that guy, the first guy. Because the first guy that something happens to in the NFL, or the first time that something happened with a player, domestic violence, alcohol issue, DWI, anything, you're going to be mentioned and it's going to be brought to light. And then the second guy happens, and they're going to say, yeah, this happened to so-and-so, just like it happened to that guy. And then the third one, you're going to be mentioned every time. And so the message was always, don't be the first guy. And Jeff used to chuckle, say, if we could get that through, he wouldn't be a first guy, and he would never be a second or third. So there were always ways to get the message across, because if you just come like it's algebra class, it makes it a long day and messages get lost. So I always found sense of humor often added to the delivery.
We're talking to Steve Watterson, longtime strength and conditioning coach for the Tennessee Titans. And nowadays, Steve, you see in the off season that if guys go back home or somewhere else, they have, you know, a training facility they go to, or they have somebody they work with. What was the communication like between you and maybe that independent trainer, so the message stayed the same and you could keep these guys on the program that you wanted to have them on?
I did do that. I used to have to call and check with them. You go back into the mid-2000s. I mean, you're going back, say, 2005, 2006, where it became more prominent. And, you know, they had changed some of the off-season rules. It was difficult to let your players go. I mean, I loved training my guys. I mean, I got to go back to 1986 when I started with the Oilers. We had a 52-week training program. 2 weeks off when the season ended, let the guys, and we had active rest. I actually gave them things that I expected them to do, even on those 2 weeks. Then we brought them back, and then we went for approximately 24 weeks of training. And then they had a couple of weeks off before training camp. And then training camp came. So, I mean, they didn't have the money. They didn't have all the other distractions. So it was great to be together. It was like being punching a clock. It was like working at a factory, and you just knew that's where you guys were all going to hook up and be together. But that changed. The athletes changed. The demand on the athletes changed. Expectations changed. And so I know some of my peers that couldn't make that change, and that's why they ended up leaving the profession. So when they would go to other places, very early I realized, don't fight it. Coordinate with it. Often you find some of these professionals were great. Now, sometimes you found out, you better get your athlete out of there, and you better find your athlete. If he doesn't want to come back home because he loves South Florida, you might want to try to find them a really reputable place that can have them prepared. Now, when athletes left, I always handed them sheets. They knew what the expectation level was, where their scores were in the past, what their scores should be this time, a minimum, and that we were going to hit it going, because I had to have a sense of expectation that they were doing something, an accountability. So they knew when they returned that they were going to be tested and evaluated on where they were at. And I can remember, I came up with a 300-yard shuttle. This goes way back in the early 80s, and it's still a favorite test used by teams now. And I can remember having guys not be able to complete the first one. And I can remember doing 180s at the training facility over there on Athens. You'll see that it's about 180 yards across all three fields. And I used to have different times, different speeds, different rest intervals for each position. And I remember Albert coming back and telling me what great shape he was in, Albert Tainsworth. But I, to be honest with you, I talked to his strength coach. Said he hadn't shown up that many times. So when he did it on his second sprint, he cramped up, his back locked up, and trainers had to come out and get him. And I said, Albert, you know, we're going to have to work together away from other guys and build a program to get your conditioning up to the other guys, because you're not ready to step in and compete with everything else that we're going to be doing. And I think that's one of the things that we might have done different than other teams. We would separate guys that we knew were not prepared to handle the workload. But coordinating with the other places and training facilities, it took a lot of time, build trust and relationships with those guys, so that you could communicate, and then you could send them some of the things that you wanted that athlete to be training. But the biggest one that was always missing, this goes back to your very first question in this interview, was getting the athletes to do their spatial awareness and reactive activities. getting them to go against another player, getting them to do something where they had to break on a reactive activity like catching a ball and then making a break and a cut, that was often the thing that was remiss or missing when the athletes trained away from the facility.
Steve, a lot of things you threw out in this interview are things we were very familiar with. We shake our heads because that's what we do away from this radio show. The training we put in away from the 4 hours we're on the air is a lot of what you described. So thank you for telling the audience what we do away from the mic. Hey, good to talk to you. Good to hear from you. Really appreciate this. And let's do it again soon. Thanks for doing this.
Great, guys. Have a great day.
All right, you too. That is Steve Watterson, a longtime strength and conditioning coach. He has story after story after story. The man could write a book easily, and it would be a book I would read, and we do appreciate him joining us. That will do it for our second hour here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. When we come back, we will start things off with you just made the list. Tell us who or what has made you mad, and then Daquan Jones will join us at the bottom of that hour at 12:30. We'll be back with that next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.